Hello, this is Kathy Hart, host of the Health First Radio Show. Today we've got some great guests on for you. In the first half, we're going to talk to Dr. Lori Hallmans, and she's written a book on the 5 steps to helping children with anxiety. And then in the second half, we're going to talk to Adrian Finkel, who has worked on the Naked Truth Project. But first, here's Alan with the Health First News.
A moss-like plant grown only in a few countries may offer better pain relief than medical marijuana, animal research suggests. THC from marijuana is used to treat conditions such as pain, muscle cramps, dizziness, and loss of appetite. However, while medical marijuana is increasingly accepted in the United States, it's illegal in many countries and can cause significant side effects. Swiss scientists are working with a potential alternative. They say the liverwort plant contains an anti-inflammatory substance called parotenidin that's related to THC. The plant only grows in Japan, New Zealand, and Costa Rica. This is still early-stage research, the scientists noticed, so medical pot won't have competition anytime soon, and research on animals often doesn't produce the same results in humans. The study was published October 24th in the journal Science Advances. Obese patients in need of a kidney transplant may find themselves denied one because of their weight, but a new study says that shouldn't happen in all cases. Researchers have found that kidneys given to obese patients fared as well as those transplanted into normal weight patients. In addition, no difference was seen in patient survival, regardless of weight. Boosting access to transplant will have a significant impact on quality of life and longevity for these patients, compared to staying on long-term dialysis, said lead researcher Dr. Bhavna Chopra, a nephrologist at Allegheny General Hospital in Pittsburgh. The results of the study were scheduled for presentation at the annual meeting of the American Society of Nephrology last week. A new gene therapy might help improve motor symptoms in people with Parkinson's disease who aren't responding to other therapies, an early study has found. James Beck, chief scientific officer of the Parkinson's Foundation, stressed this is not a cure of Parkinson's disease. This is a potentially good treatment for symptom control. It provides an additional way of providing dopamine to the brain, but it doesn't stop the progression of Parkinson's disease. The new treatment uses a virus to deliver gene therapy to a targeted area of the brain. The gene therapy affects an enzyme called AADC. This enzyme transforms levodopa into dopamine in the brain. Results of the study were presented recently at the American Neurological Association meeting. The wave of marijuana legalization that swept across the United States in recent years has been fueled in part by the popular belief that pot is essentially harmless. But a new study shows that some heavy users will experience withdrawal symptoms while coming down from their high. About 1 in 10 frequent cannabis users report symptoms like anxiety, hostility, insomnia, and depression after the intoxicating effects of weed start to wear off, said senior researcher Deborah Hassan, a professor of epidemiology at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. These folks might be using pot to help treat their anxiety or depression, unaware they're putting the cart before the horse, Hassan said. The new study was published recently in the journal Drug and Alcohol Dependence.
Hello, this is Kathy, and we are speaking with Dr. Lori Hallmans today. She is has her PhD. She has done a lot of psychoanalysis work, and she specialized in children and anxiety. So you've done lots of work around children and how to keep them calm and happy and in a world where there's so much anxiousness. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for welcoming me.
So, what led you to do all this work with children and anxiety?
Well, my practice is my psychoanalytic practice is with children, infants, children, teenagers, and adults. So, after working with so many parents, I decided that it was time to write down what I do so that maybe more people than just the people in my practice and gain from the 5 steps of parental intelligence when their kids are anxious or angry or very upset.
Lori, give us an idea. How many children, is it like 1 out of 10, 1 out of 20? How many are really suffering with clinical anxiety?
The statistic is 1 out of 20. I don't really know if that's correct because all I see are kids with anxiety. So I don't see the full spectrum, but it certainly is common.
So by the time they see you, it's not just anxiety once in a while, it's chronic anxiety.
Yes, exactly.
And what are some of the ways that we can help children then?
Well, if you'd like, I could give you an illustration of using the 5 steps. Would that help?
Sure, that would be great.
Okay. So imagine a 10-year-old Lydia whose mother figures out the whys behind Lydia's anxiety. What happens is Lydia comes home from school. She's sitting at the kitchen table, drumming her fingers on her cheek, staring at her homework with papers scattered all around. She's clearly anxious about something, and she seems angry. And the first step, stepping back, is what her mother does. She pauses, surprisingly, instead of jumping in, and takes some time to see if Lydia can gain control of herself on her own, because that would be important if she could. She thinks about all the times she sees Lydia anxious, so she doesn't rush in with solutions. She remains calm and non-judgmental of her daughter, which is very important. Stepping back gives parents permission to not know what to do immediately, because how can you act before you understand the reasons behind the anxiety?
Mm-hmm.
So she takes her time, and then the second step is self-reflecting, where you think about how you feel in response to how your child is behaving. She knows that she's busy preparing dinner, so she can be relieved by her husband shortly to go out to speak at a fundraiser that night. So she's a little anxious herself about giving this talk, and she knows that anxious mother, anxious daughter aren't a good match, so she has to calm herself down, which is what she does. And she decides if dinner has to be on hold, if she has to call out for pizza, Lydia comes first. So she sees Lydia trembling. She's certainly not reducing her anxiety, and she decides that she has to do the third step of parental intelligence, which is understanding your child's mind, basically asking, why is my child acting this way? So she sits with Lydia, puts her arm around her, and asks her, what's the matter? Is something going wrong today? Now Lydia is going to help her mother know the meaning behind her anxiety. Crying, she says, she didn't make the first cut on the lacrosse team. Now, that doesn't sound like an anxiety-producing situation, but for this Lydia, it is. This means to her not being in the popular crowd. Her mother asks her an open-ended question to see if she'll tell her more. And she says it means next year she won't make the travel team, and that's a way to get a scholarship to college. It feels so unfair, she says. I'm a good, loyal player on the team. Now her mother sees that her daughter is both anxious and angry, and because of social anxiety, being part of the popular kids, and unusually long-term worries about college. After all, she's only 10 years old. So she notes her anger because she's left out and how this feels unfair. So she decides to focus on the most erroneous conclusion, which is the college idea, because it's so far away. And she says to her daughter, college, that's years away. You have a superb academic record and surely will by high school. Do you think we can take things one at a time? Next term you can try out again. Lydia's mother has now gone also to the next step of parental intelligence, which is step four, understanding your child's development. She sees her daughter is a worrywart about the future, far beyond what a girl her age should be worried about. When Lydia's given her mother's reasonable perspective, she slows her crying down, she hugs her mother, and she says, I don't feel dizzy anymore. My chest stopped pounding. I thought I'd never feel better. With that, her mother knew that Lydia was on her way to a full-blown panic attack, which was stopped when her mother understood her mindset and gave her a new perspective. So now problem-solving was actually underway, which is the fifth step. The two decide she'll try again next term. She settles down to do her homework. So her mother postponed talking about her social anxiety to another calmer time when they would both have more time. Her mother was very relieved because she had not used her parental intelligence when she began to leave for the fundraiser. She thought Lydia's separation anxiety would have been triggered. So in about 15 minutes, Lydia was calmer, her mother felt relieved, and parental intelligence had averted a big anxious crisis. So that's how it works.
Wow, and that's all from tapping fingers on the table.
Yes, absolutely.
So it'd be so easy as a parent when you're cooking and you have something to do right after dinner to say, I don't have time for this, just quit tapping your fingers.
Exactly, that would be a very typical response. And it would only escalate the anxiety. That's the unfortunate part.
And all these five steps, when you have them under your belt and you use them on a consistent basis, can actually be quite time-saving.
Yes, absolutely. That's why the book is called For the Busy Parent, because when you have a structure inside of yourself of five steps that you know you can automatically go into, it saves you time. You know, it feels like, oh, how can I go through all that when I'm so busy? But actually, knowing what to do does help you when you're busy. And it, in this example, it helps the daughter and the mother.
And the first stage was just awareness, really watching rather than ignoring. I know with children, I mean, mine are all grown up, but often I would like, rather than be aware of it, kind of ignore it until it got like, okay, now we have to really be aware of it. Catching it while it's small seems like where it would be the easiest to speak about it as well.
Yes, absolutely. So you're reflective, not reactive, is the basic idea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You understand before you ask.
Mm-hmm. So if using these parenting skills, do you think it could alleviate a lot of the having kids go right into the medical system and having medications? And because we see kids all the time that they might want all sorts of Nervines and Ativan, things like that, and they're only teenagers.
Yeah, you're right. I've experienced in my practice that if I lend parents these tools, they know what to do when they're at home, and it lessens the need for medication because the anxiety is lessened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people need medication, there's no doubt about it, but hopefully not until they're at least teenagers, because the brain is still developing, and you really don't want to interfere if you don't have to.
Right. So there's actually real biochemical changes that happen in the body, in the brain, when we get anxious.
What actually happens?
Yeah, what actually happens? There is actually a change in chemicals, isn't there?
Yes, yes. Actually, what happens is you start breathing quickly, and that shallow breathing makes the child scared and even more anxious, unless they have a parent who knows this is a typical symptom of anxiety and can calm the child down. Because anxiety breeds anxiety. Once you feel once you feel close to a panic attack, you do panic. You actually get scared. So you need a parent to tell you to slow down the breathing. And one way to physically do it is to cup your hands over your mouth and your nose and breathe slowly. And that balances the carbon dioxide and the oxygen. And the temperature, emotional temperature, comes down.
Hmm. And so it might be good for the parent to do that first for a minute or two before they even dive in.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
What caused you to start all your work with anxiety in children?
Well, I've been working for 30 years at this problem, so.
Mm-hmm. And what have you seen over 30 years? Have you seen a change in the problems?
The only thing I've seen is that parents are more willing to bring their kids for treatment. There's less of a stigma. And that in the teenagers, they're so much more open with each other about their problems. Like a child who has OCD tells their friends, so their friends help them. It's really very, that's a big change in this generation, that the kids, even if the parents find there's a stigma, the kids don't. And they share it with each other, and they help each other. It's
mm-hmm.
wonderful.
Wow. And so really getting the parents educated is the blessing to the children.
Absolutely, absolutely. The kids are really ready. Kids often ask their parents, can I go to therapy? The teenagers
right.
do.
Yeah.
But their friends do, and they learn that their friends are feeling better. So they bring it up, and then the parents realize, okay, I have to push myself beyond this feeling of stigma and call somebody and have a consultation.
Do you think there's a lot less stigma now to dealing with anxiety and depression and things?
I think so. I think in general, yes. And I think the new generations are definitely much more at ease with the notion that so many people are anxious, so many people are under stress. And with busy parents, it's really important for them to know that they're not alone and that there's really a lot of help out there.
Wonderful. We're going to have to go to a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk more about ways to avoid anxiety and deal with anxiety with Dr. Lori Holman. So we'll be right back.